Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight-loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight-loss. PlushCare.com/weight-loss.
Now, of course, we've all got a grotto under our home, but what did London's leading architect of his day keep in his? And what's the origin of the distinctive shape of the British telephone box? It's Friday, April the 19th, 2013. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud. London, Michaelmas term lately over.
London.
Okay, you know where you are. A radical transformation.
Very radical transformation.
People are morally outraged with what's going on.
I got very excited this week.
Seemed reasonable, didn't it?
As soon as you scratch the surface, you realise gore happened all across London. Every open square
really
would have a gallery.
Place called the Kittle Hoosie. Saw your Geordie's Grace riding on a goosey.
What the hell is that?
A man is tired of London. He's tired of
so
life.
So what was the first thing that caught your eye?
The South has an overstuffed walrus.
It's very important history.
A handwritten letter from Charles Dickens.
There's a piece of information we're missing here somewhere.
You snake through the city, what, immersing yourself in the sight, sound,
and for the Jewish community, who came over in their tens of thousands from Russia, from Poland.
We are doing a modern take on Morris dancing.
When did he think the second coming was going to happen?
Yes, Boris. He wants to put an airport.
the tone with which Boris has announced it is fatigued.
Yes, the city is always changing. People frequently say to me, you know, won't it be wonderful when it's finished? And I say, no, it'll be dreadful. It'll mean it's dead.
Inform and entertain, that's what it's about.
London is a modern Babylon.
That's very true.
Can we have some of the detail here? Well, for a pleasant change, we've got some nice carpet to stand on. Always good. I'm here in Sir John Soane's Museum, which is already delighting me. Lots of dark wood and books, which is a good thing in any building. I'm here with Dr. Frances Sands. She is the catalogue editor at Sir John Soane's Museum. Hi.
Hello, welcome to the Soane Museum.
Thank you. What a beautiful place. Really does feel like a home as well as a museum, of course.
Well, absolutely. It is a house museum simply because it was the home of Sir John Soane, the leading architect of his generation, as well as being his museum, which he used to teach his students, his architectural students at the Royal Academy during the Napoleonic Wars when they couldn't travel over to Italy and observe the classical ruins from which, of course, they were trying to learn how to build in the classical tradition. The first thing you see when you enter the Soane Museum is a rather beautiful portrait by Sir Thomas Lawrence of Sir John Soane himself. In the portrait, Soane is in his 70s and shown as a very wealthy gentleman by this point in his life. He's become the leading architect of the day. He's made an awful lot of money. He doesn't quite look as old as he actually is because he's wearing a rather fine horsehair wig.
Is that a wig?
It's an absolutely beautiful image, and it is very deliberately the first thing you see. Soane wants you to know that this is his house, his museum, and you mustn't forget it as you go around.
He does look like the Duke of Wellington, doesn't he?
He does a little bit. Known for being very tall and thin, but yes, a prominent nose, certainly.
Would they have been contemporaneous?
Just about, yes. Yes, they would have been, yeah. We'll see a bust of Soane by Francis Chantrey later on in the museum, and you get a good profile of the nose.
Before we sort of look into the museum, I know we're going to talk about his journey into architecture in particular, but can we say something about him as a person and the kind of the environment in which he grew up and developed, and perhaps the grand tour, those kind of things?
Certainly. It is a little bit surprising that Soane ended up being the leading architect of his day, because he came from very humble origins. He was born in 1753 in Goring-on-Thames near Reading, and he was the son of a bricklayer, And his father unfortunately died when he was only 14 years old, which meant that the family could no longer afford to pay his school fees. He had to leave school with the intention of becoming a bricklayer alongside his older brother. But happily for Soane, a family friend who was a fairly mediocre contemporary architect noticed that he was a very naturally gifted draftsman, and he acquired for him an apprenticeship in the office of the fairly prominent Georgian architect, George Dance the Younger. So the young Soane, at only the age of 16, was whisked up to London to learn how to be an architect with Dance. Fantastic opportunity for a young man who otherwise would have had little choice in life. But he was actually very ambitious himself. You know, while he was an apprentice, he also joined the Royal Academy in order to make use of their library, attend their lectures, and most importantly of all, to submit an architectural drawing to their annual competition, which of course still runs today. And in 1776, when Soane was in his 20s, he actually won the Royal Academy annual competition. He won the gold medal, which means that he got to meet the king, who of course in 76 everyone knows was George III. Everyone knows their history, of course. And George III was so impressed with this very gifted, self-made young man that he gave him a thing called the King's Travelling Bursary, which sounds terribly grand, but it was £60 a year to travel on.
Nothing to be sniffed at.
No, certainly not. He wouldn't have had the chance to go abroad otherwise, but this meant that Soane got to go on the Grand Tour between 1778 and 1780, an educational activity usually for the offspring of wealthy people to learn about foreign culture, art, antiquities, history, and usually to collect art and antiquities while they were there. But of course Soane didn't have the money for that. He was simply making drawings of the beautiful ruins that he saw. Unfortunately, he lost many of his drawings when his luggage fell off his coach as he was coming home crossing the Alps. But another souvenir he brought back was a cinder from Mount Vesuvius, which we still have in a little box upstairs, which is rather lovely.
Came back, of course, and he's massively in debt by that point, wasn't he? Even though it sounds as though he's been careful with his money.
Yes, he was in debt to the tune of £180, which doesn't sound like much to us, but it was an awful lot. If you bear in mind that a housemaid would be earning about £10 a year in those days, £180 is a huge sum of money. But fortunately for Soane, when he returned in 1780, he set up his architectural office in London straight away and quite quickly became successful. And this was helped along by the fact that 4 years later he met and fell in love with a lovely young lady called Eliza Smith. They got married and her very wealthy uncle settled £1,000 on them. So he was able to relax a little bit then, concentrate on his architecture, and it paid off because 4 years after that, in 1788, he was made architect of the Bank of England. Pretty impressive stuff for an architect in his 30s.
Now we've had the patronage of His Majesty already, and getting to work on the Bank of England was also an act of, friendship as well as patronage.
Absolutely. Soane had made an awful lot of useful contacts during his grand tour. Around 350 of his architectural projects can be traced back to someone who he'd met. He'd actually met various members of the Pitt family while he was on the grand tour, and of course this was the fantastic connection that really acquired for him the job at the Bank of England. I mean, let's not forget he was an extraordinarily gifted architect, but had he not had friends in the right places, it probably would never have come about.
Which seems to suggest he must have been pretty personable.
I would imagine so. I mean, generally when you read his correspondence, he comes across as very friendly, very respectful, hugely intelligent and gifted, but I think also probably a little bit difficult too, as most great gifted men tend to be.
What makes you think that?
Well, I mean, just look at his house. I think his wife had a lot to put up with.
Well, do you know what? Having visited a number of museums of very different types around London, the one commonality seems to be long-suffering wives.
I think that's very true. Eliza Soane, of course, brought the money with the wealthy uncle who actually then died in 1790 and left the young couple the bulk of his wealth. He was what we would think of as a property developer here in London. But I think that she sort of just let Soane get on with it, really. He was sort of a genius architect, but as I say, quite a difficult man. She just went with it and did buy a few bits and pieces herself, including Hogarth's Rake's Progress, which is rather amusing.
When we say he's a genius architect, is it possible to qualify that a little bit?
Certainly. Why don't we move over and look at an architectural model of Soane's? Here in the library dining room, we have a beautiful architectural model, Soane's family monument, which he designed in 1815 when his wife Eliza sadly died. Soane is generally referred to as the father of modernism, because he was very innovative. If you look at this beautiful little model in the library dining room, you can see that Soane loved layering. There's an inside layer which shows a fairly traditional Ionic classical temple, nothing that would be out of place in ancient Greece or Rome. In fact, Soane has taken this very design from an antique urn which is directly opposite the beautiful little model in the library dining room. But then if you look back at the model, you can see there's also an outside layer, a black bit, which makes use of the Ionic order, but the beautiful scrolling capitals are shown in relief. Every single architectural motif is pared down to its absolute bare minimum. He does the same with the chimney pieces in this room, which look more like they're from the 1920s or 30s. So really, Soane is 100 years ahead of his time, and for very good reason is called the father of modernism.
I'm resisting saying that this looks a little bit like a TARDIS.
There's a very good reason for that.
But, yes, in fact, I know exactly where you're going with that. But this reminds me a little bit of kind of an Art Deco, you know, as architecture drifted into Art Deco. So it really is ahead of its time in that respect.
Absolutely, he is 100 years ahead of his time. But really, when you're looking at this beautiful little architectural model of the family monument, the main thing to look at is the top of it. It makes use of a square-based shallow dome, which Soane used all over the place, including in the Bank of England, the Freemasons Hall, here in the museum itself. But it's also a lovely example of how inspirational Soane was and still is today, because actually this particular design is the inspiration for the red telephone box, which is why you said it looks like a TARDIS.
Mm-hmm. What's the sort of cylindrical, fairly shallow cylindrical thing on the top there? It looks like it's got a kind of a flame sculpture on top of that.
Well, that particular motif that you can see ornamenting that is actually called stridulation. It's like fluting but curvy in the form of a Roman stridule that you'd use in your bathhouse to wash yourself with to scrape the oil off your skin. That's where the motif comes from. This particular architectural motif on the funerary monument design is purely ornamental but is inspired by antique domes which have a lantern on top. There would be windows around the edges allowing light to filter into the inside of a dome, because if you look up into a dome which is very large and there's no top light source, it can look rather gloomy. So lanterns are a very clever way of internally lighting a dome area.
So what I suppose I'm a little confused about is he clearly soaked up influences while he's on the tour, and these are a classical, they're, you know, nearly 2,000 years old, and yet somehow the style that emerges is ahead of its time. How did that work?
Well, I don't think anyone can really say. I mean, Soane was extraordinarily gifted. He took the inspiration that was flung at him whilst on the Grand Tour, and this is what he came out with. You know, that's why he was so successful and so important, because he really did something amazing and innovative. I mean, of course, helped along by the fact that he had quite a lot of money behind him and he could afford to be creative. He could afford to take the clients that he did or didn't want and do the projects, indeed, that he did or didn't want.
Was he seen as risky or a safe pair of hands?
Not as far as I know. I mean, he was very good at building on budget, which I don't think many architects these days are. But no, very well respected generally, I believe. So I would say a safe pair of hands, yeah.
Well, now I've got to challenge this budget thing, because I know that he was commissioned to look at doing some churches. And they had, I think, £12,000 or something along those lines to spend on each one. And I've looked at what they came in at eventually, and that was not on budget.
Well, architectural projects. You can't ask for the moon, can you?
So this was a good innings, maybe compared to other architects bringing it in at £100,000 a church.
Bear in mind, the vast majority of 18th century architects are building at double their budget. I mean, that's perfectly normal. I personally specialise in Robert and James Adam, and they tend to quadruple their budget. So I think Soane's doing pretty well, really.
Something's never changed, eh? There's such a wealth of stuff in this room, and I'm particularly interested by this peculiar arrangement. If you were looking just at the top 2 feet of the as we meet the ceiling here, it looks as though the arches are going to turn into columns and come down and support the roof, but the columns are truncated 2 feet down to allow us to walk underneath them.
These are what we call hanging pendentive arches. Soane is very dramatic in his architectural style. His three principles of architecture were light, space and invention, and I think that's really shown off very well with those hanging pendentive arches, particularly because you can see them from every angle, because there are mirrors inserted above the bookcases on the walls behind them. Soane loves to use mirror to kind of make exciting and And unusual architectural spaces look even more unusual. You know, it makes the room look double its size. It creates clever forms of lighting. Soane was particularly good with clever lighting. I mean, he was the architect of the Bank of England. He produced vaults, the first what we would think of as modern banking vaults, which were both secure and yet top lit by natural light. Mm. There are actually architects nowadays looking back at Soane to see if they can learn anything to make modern architecture more environmentally friendly, that is, lit by natural means rather than having to use electricity.
Mm. And of course, he made them. He made the vaults fireproof as well, which was quite innovative.
Absolutely, he was a great one for that sort of barrel vaults, etc., and use of brick. I mean, of course, you've got to bear in mind that fire is a big issue, and a lot of architects do become successful because they are able to do that, produce architecture which is fireproof. I mean, look at Christopher Wren. It all starts there, really. But yes, Soane is a great one for that. I'm not sure, however, whether the Soane Museum is particularly fireproof, but that's another matter. Altogether.
It being as it seems to be entirely wooden, we're going to question. But actually, that's I don't know if we will maybe come on to talk about that. But I know a lot of his buildings have been lost in horrible ways, including fire.
Yeah, there aren't a great many left. Soane produced over 150 country houses, various churches, of course, lots of public commissions like Dulwich Picture Gallery, parts of the Palace of Westminster, which of course burnt down. I mean, Soane is a hugely significant and famous architect, but one does wonder if it weren't for the Soane Museum whether he would be as well known now as he is today, because so much of the work is lost, and indeed so much of his work was never actually built in the first place. So really, with the museum, he got to play around, do the things he wanted to do, irrespective of whether there was someone willing to pay him to do it or not.
Now, what was the impetus behind this place? What was it intended to be? Was it always going to be a museum from the beginning?
Ah, well, it's a fairly complicated story. In 1790, John and Eliza Soane inherited all of the uncle's wealth from Eliza's uncle, the property developer, enabling them to start buying property here in Lincoln's Inn Fields. The first house they purchased was number 12. If you're looking at the museum, it's the house on the far left-hand side, because, of course, the museum is composed of three houses. They buy that house in 1792. The thing to know about that house is that it's very small. The party wall between numbers 12 and 13 is diagonally slanting, so 12 gets smaller towards the back and 13 gets bigger. But they fitted a lot in. It was their family home principally, because they had two sons at that date, or by that date, I should say, John Jr. and George. But it was also the location of Soane's architectural office, so he had his students crammed in there. And it's also the location of Soane's embryonic collection, which at that date is purely for his own inspirational purposes. And that's absolutely fine. But everything changed 14 years later, in 1806, by which point Soane is hugely successful and famous. And in 1806, he was invited to become Professor of Architecture at the Royal Academy. Of course, in 1806, the Napoleonic Wars were raging. Soane's students couldn't go to Italy the way he had done to learn about architecture. So in his first ever lecture at the Royal Academy, he invited his students, some 600 young men each year, to come to his home, his private family home, and make use of his collection as a sort of grand tour in microcosm. So he starts using the collection as a teaching aid, and rather unsurprisingly, therefore, it grows and grows and grows with greater speed. And Soane very quickly runs out of space in that small house, number 12. So only 1 year after he's made a professor at the Royal Academy, Soane acquired the freehold of the larger neighbouring house, number 13. It wasn't actually the front, the domestic part that he wanted. In those days, it was a 17th century townhouse. What he wanted was the stables at the back, because he was living at the front of 12, and he wanted to extend his own museum, which was in his own state, into the neighbouring stable, so he had a big double-width museum at the back of his house.
So he bought it for the shed, basically.
That's it. I mean, you know, are we surprised, really?
But just a word on the area quickly, because yeah. Within 50 years or so, this area had a reputation for being the legal centre of things. Was that going on at that point?
Yeah, I mean, the legal profession has been in this particular area of London since the medieval period. Lincoln's Inn Fields was originally the playing fields for the young boys learning to be lawyers in Lincoln's Inn. And in the 17th century, it was enclosed by buildings all around it, forming what we now know of as the largest square in London. Of course, the great thing about Lincoln's Inn Fields is it is full of lawyers, so no one would ever dare build on it. The lawyers would probably eat them alive. But that was a great boon for Soane. You know, he moved here. It wasn't the most salubrious part of London. He could have lived somewhere much more expensive if he'd wanted to. But he picked Lincoln's Inn Fields for various good reasons. You know, we're right facing on to the largest square. providing Soane with fantastic quality of light for drawing all day. Of course, he's drawing at a time when there's no benefit of artificial electrical light. But also, we're right on High Holborn, where all the coaching inns were. So it's a fantastic commuter link for Soane to get out to his patrons in the country who are building big country houses. And then there are other incidental fantastic things around London in this area. Of course, we're within walking distance of the Strand, so Soane could go to the theatre, which he loved to do. We've got lots of playbooks in the archive. We're within walking distance of the Bank of England, most of which was sadly demolished in the 1920s, and of course Soane worked there for 45 years. And we're also, of course, within walking distance of the poor old Palace of Westminster, which burnt down, which Soane both worked at and consulted on quite regularly throughout his career. So it was a really fantastic location for Soane to have picked, and that's why really he stayed here right from 1790 through to his death in 1837.
And that's very interesting that you've made that connection between the draftsman's tools and light as well, because, of course, as you say, it was necessary for him to be able to see in detail what he's doing, almost with the sensitivity of an artist, presumably.
Absolutely.
And of course, we find that he's very concerned with light. That seems to all tie together.
That's it. He moved around the building at different times of day to get the best light possible. His own study, which we'll see further on in the museum, is very small. It wasn't large enough to produce the light required for architectural drawings. And sadly for Soane, his eyesight started to fail him towards the end of his life. In the Lawrence portrait, he's holding a pair of spectacles because his eyesight has started to fail. At the end of his life, he wasn't actually even able to read his own lectures at the Royal Academy. So his friend, a painter called Henry Howard, read his lectures for him, which was rather nice.
We've got two of the houses now. Do I take it that he continues, yes, further along the street?
The story continues on.
Is there any stopping him?
No, certainly not. In 1807, Soane had acquired number 13, leased out the front and extended his museum into the back. But of course, his collection continued to grow. So 5 years later, he decided he'd actually quite like to live in the bigger house in number 13 himself. So he kicked his tenants over into number 12, the small house, kept hold of his double width museum at the back. He rebuilt number 13 in the way that you see it now, this fantastic surviving building that we're standing in at the moment, and moved in, giving him more space. But of course, the collection continued to grow, and inevitably he ran out of space again. And everything came to a head 12 years later, in 1824, when Soane bought Hogarth's Election Series, four large, significant canvases, Hogarth being an important British artist, beautiful canvases lampooning the British electoral process. They're quite comic, actually. And Soane spent £1,700 on them, an awful lot of money. But by this date, he had no wall space left. And of course, you don't buy important, expensive works of art and then not hang them. So we went back to his old tricks, and he acquired the freehold of the neighbouring house on the other side, number 14, did the same again, rebuilt, leased out the front, and extended the museum into the stables at the back. We actually have a rather fantastic drawing upstairs, which shows that he had it in mind to keep going and buy numbers 15 and 16 and 17 and so on.
I did wonder.
But by the time he bought number 14, he was in his 70s, so I suspect he was slowing down a bit by then.
I imagine the people living over there were quite grateful for his failing eyesight. Is that the museum at the back that you're referring to?
The lovely thing about the Soane Museum is that you can walk in any order you want. We don't do the velvet rope thing. You can just wander free range. And the whole house is a museum. You know, there are domestic spaces, but they're still filled with museum objects.
We should perhaps look at some of those objects.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 16,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to a CD. And they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
And we're passing through from the large front room, which, as I mentioned, feels like a front room. And I notice one of the most elegant ways of keeping people from sitting on the chairs is to put a little bristly sort of pine, dried teasels. Pine cones. What are they?
Teasels.
Teasels. There we go. You wouldn't sit on a teasel.
No. Get a prickly bottom. It really does the trick. We've moved into a little tiny room, which is Soane's private study. It's got a beautiful little desk under the window, not large enough for producing architectural drawings, but certainly large enough for writing correspondence. Soane's very good at designing small furniture in a sort of maritime-esque way. At his feet, seat at this desk, he would have, or still had, there's a beautiful polished brass plate in the floor, which is the remnants of Soane's very early central heating system, which worked like a Roman hypocaust system with a boiler pumping hot air around under the floor. Unfortunately, it didn't work very well, and the house was usually about 12 degrees centigrade. So at Soane's back in his study, he has a chimneypiece to keep him warm. Not everyone in the building would have been so lucky. All around us in this space, we have antique casts and antique fragments and casts of antique fragments, all from the collection of Henry Holland, who was another Georgian architect who happened to be Soane's second teaching master after George Dance the Younger. Now, generally, when Soane bought someone else's collection, as indeed he regularly did in the auction houses here in London, he would disperse it within the museum as he saw fit. But this particular collection he kept all together in one place in his private study as a memorial to his teacher. So he's a bit of a sentimental old thing, really.
Yes, this really does feel like a private place, even though you walk through it to get to other places. It feels enclosed. And looking up, we can see a remarkable thing. It looks like it must be a cast. And it depicts three tiers, possibly, no, four tiers, of people going about their business in a Romany fashion, wearing togas, and there's a chap on a throne here, oxen. What's going on up there?
Well, I mean, this is the problem. I've been a curator here for 3 years. Our acting director has been here 28 years. You point at an individual object, the vast majority of us will go, I have no idea, because there are over 60,000 objects in this museum.
All on display?
Not all. Well, 60,000 objects on display. We've also got a large archive upstairs. We think this is the best archived domestic building in the world. We've got a collection of 10,000 antique books. We've got a collection of 40,000 architectural drawings, and all sorts of interesting paintings and casts and things in the curatorial offices. So lots to be seen. If you ever want to come and look at any of the stuff behind the scenes, all you have to do is make an appointment with our librarian. You can come and look at whatever you want.
Well, that's remarkable. A lot of museums just don't have the ability to serve that sort of purpose.
Well, we are the smallest national museum in the country, which does mean that we get a small stipend from the government, despite the cuts. So that pays core staff costs. The rest we raise ourselves, so people should come along and note the donation box and the shop. But no, we try our very best. You know, this is a national collection, a very significant collection, and what's the point of having these wonderful things if people can't use them?
Absolutely. Well, that seems very much in the spirit that the collection was established, of course, as a teacher. Aid and something to be absorbed rather than just admired from a distance. And I see there's the Royal Coat of Arms on the wall at the far end of the corridor.
Royal Coat of Arms, rather amusingly, over the back entrance, which the servants would have come in through, now locked, I'm afraid. You can see it through Soane's private dressing room. Soane had his own private loo, which the public can't get into, but it's terribly smart for a person in the early 19th century to have a private loo. So we'll just walk past it and have a look at the rest of the museum.
Yes, this does have a sort of a maritime feel in places. Very narrow corridors, barely enough to get your shoulders through if you walk in the normal way. And we're now through to an area which almost defies description. It's almost as though somebody has made a Roman temple in the back room.
We're standing underneath a mezzanine on top of which Soane's architectural students would have worked. It's resting on columns which are recycled from part of the old Bank of England, which Soane rebuilt, so it is a bit dark in this area. But looking to either side, on one side we have Soane's picture room, his response to the National Gallery, which had opened in 1824, filled with over 100 paintings, absolutely beautiful, some Canaletto's, Turner's, Hogarth's, you name it, we've got it. And then on the right-hand side of us, we've got what we call the dome area, filled with all sorts of casts and fragments, which, well, again, this defy description, but we've got an early 18th century cast of the Apollo Belvedere. We've got the Francis Chantrey bust of Soane himself. We've got some beautiful composite antique urns from the collection of Robert and James Adam. All sorts of things. You sort of have to come to see to believe it, really.
You mentioned that the Adams are part of your area of interest. Do you have any influence in new items coming here, or is it a matter of curating what already exists?
Ah, well, this is a static collection. The museum was established in 1833 by Soane when he was 80 years old with a private act of Parliament with two stipulations. One was that entry should always be free, which of course it still is, and two, that the museum should be kept as much as possible as it was when Soane died, which she did indeed do in 1837. So we don't buy things unless they had once been in the collection and unfortunately been lost or sold or stolen occasionally. Far from it, we don't move things around. If we ever do, it's to put things back to how Soane had them and undo the work of well-meaning 19th century curators.
What problems have you inherited from how Soane did things?
All manner of problems. There is so much stuff in this building, you can hardly move.
So you're limited on the number? Because I noticed there was a small queue outside. Yeah. Presumably you have to keep a one in, one out type policy going
on. Yeah, I mean, the old health and safety issue. You can only have a certain number of people in here at any given time. There is only so much space. We're about to start the second phase of our opening up the Soane project, during which we're going to, for the first time, open to the public Soane's private apartments on the second floor of the museum. So if you come back in 2015 or towards the end of 2015, you'll be able to see Soane's bedroom, his book room, his oratory, his bathroom, that sort of thing. And of course that will reduce greater space in the museum, so just quite literally a larger number of people will fit at any given time.
I got the impression that his private life and his work life are pretty thoroughly mixed together. What's the differences between the sort of lavish surroundings here and his private apartments?
Very little. we'll go up and see the drawing rooms shortly. The domestic spaces have slightly fewer objects from within the collection in them, but they're still very much museum spaces. You know, this is a man, as you say, whose private life, his working life and his collecting life are all intertwined in one very small space. So, you know, it's sort of a grey area.
I'm always interested where somebody is working in the space of a great name like Soane. Do you feel you've got a personal relationship with the man?
I feel that anyone who works in or visits the Soane Museum is sort of like a puppet at the end of Soane's strings. You know, we're all doing exactly what he wants. We're engaging with his architecture, his collection. We're engaging with his private act of parliament. Everything we do in this building goes back to what Soane wanted and what he envisaged. And that's absolutely fine because he was an extraordinary man. But you do sort of sometimes think, you know, how many lives have been affected by this incredible collection.
Hmm. One life that was certainly affected was that of George Soane. Now, if I've understood it correctly, John and George Soane turned out to be a little bit of a disappointment to Sir John Soane. I think he had another child as well who passed away quite early on, but then two sons who were a bit of a letdown.
Yeah, the Soanes sadly had five children and only two of them made it past infancy.
Oh goodness.
John, unfortunately, died in his early 30s from consumption. He had shown some interest in following in his father's footsteps and becoming an architect, but of course he was unwell throughout his entire life and never really managed to achieve anything. George, the younger son, who actually did make it to old age, showed no interest in architecture at all, which was upsetting for Soane because he was keen that his son should establish an architectural dynasty, a Soane dynasty as it were. George was actually quite a gifted playwright, but he never made a great deal of money from it, and therefore relied heavily on his father's income. He actually misbehaved quite badly. You know, he actually got his sister-in-law pregnant at one point, which of course his father didn't approve of, and this all culminated in 1815 when George ended up in debtor's prison. He applied to his father to bail him out, and Sir John Soane said, you know, look, you're a middle-aged man, you've got children of your own, I'm sick of it, sort yourself out. George didn't like this. You get the impression he was quite spoiled, and when a few months later he finally got out of debtor's prison, he got his own back by writing two articles for a publication called The Champion, in which he very heavily criticised his father and his collection and his architectural output. Very embarrassing considering how famous Soane was by this point. And Soane felt very betrayed, but worse still was Eliza's reaction. You know, she read her son's words and she was just heartbroken. And the story goes that she took to her bed and she died 2 months later. So Soane really felt that George had killed his wife. And he took the two articles and he framed them, and at the bottom of the frame was a little plaque which read Death Blows. And the death blows were the only thing that George inherited when Soane died. So George was disinherited, freeing up the museum to be left to the nation, which is possibly a good thing because it means it survives.
So we have his swinishness to thank.
Yes, quite possibly.
Well, let's keep pedalling. So which way next?
We'll go downstairs.
Okay. We're passing by the regal relief there. Lots of penises on display. I should emphasise that they are attached to statues. We've got a bust here of a fellow with a moustache. I wish I had a moustache like that. And the atmosphere downstairs is once again different. It really does seem that every room has an entirely unique and very sophisticated character of its own. As we move into the area here, we've come through a doorway and we're surrounded by faces, sort of gargoyle-y, churchy faces, some masks of horror. A gnome over there, I think. To my left, there's a very prim-looking dining table, a little circular table. It has the top part of a skull on it and some finely upholstered chairs in red velvet-like material, surrounded by very expensive-looking vases, which I shall be juggling later. And above me, well, this is very peculiar because the ceiling above the table is probably 7 or 8 feet up. But the ceiling above where I'm standing right now, it must be 20 or 30 feet high, and there's a barrel vault across the top letting in sunlight, a statue looking down on us, and portraits and landscapes up there as well. What a crowded place.
We are now at the back of number 14, the third house which Soane bought, and we're actually downstairs in what was the wine cellar beneath the stables. In what had been the stables behind 14, Soane produced his picture room, where he put over 118 paintings. He crams them all in by the use of planes, which is terribly clever. But beneath the picture room, in what had been the wine cellar, Soane produced a suite of spaces for a fictional monk called Padre Giovanni. Giovanni for John, it's terribly funny. And these three spaces are composed of the monk's cell, where Padre Giovanni would sleep. That contains a real human skeleton, which had once been the life model for John Flaxman, the sculptor, who was very good friends with Soane during his lifetime. So if you look through the windows, you come down the stairs, you'll see the skeleton. I suspect Soane kept the closet in which it lives shut most of the time, because it is a bit shocking. The space in which we're standing at present is the monk's parlour, so it's the space for the fictional monk to live. It's essentially a space for taking afternoon tea, but you've got to bear in mind that at the beginning of the 19th century, the Gothic and eclectic styles were coming into fashion. And with this space, Soane was basically saying, you know, look, I'm not just a one-trick pony, I can do more than just the classical, which I've been doing for decades. And here he's sort of saying, you know, I can do the Gothic too. He was very interested in ecclesiastical architecture, wasn't religious himself, but he was on the church board and worked on various churches. And in this space, as you said, the ceiling is very high in one area and low in another. We've got a sort of nave and chancel arrangement. And we're surrounded by casts and fragments, this time principally of medieval origin, so appropriate for the narrative of the fictional monk. And then we've also got some beautiful Flemish stained glass in the window. And if you look through that, you'll look into a space called the monk's yard. That contains recycled ruins from part of the Palace of Westminster, which Soane rebuilt. He was a great one for recycling. And within the narrative of the monk, the recycled ruins are sort of faux monastic ruins for Padre Giovanni to look after.
Up until the moment we arrived here, I was thinking that this Soane fellow seemed reasonably well balanced and very passionate about his architecture, but this is a bit nuts, isn't it?
This is a bit crazy. You've got to bear in mind, this is 1824, 9 years after Eliza Soane has died. At this date, Soane is referring to himself as being like a hermit alone in his cell, so I think he might be a bit depressive. But equally, you know, a great genius. He is trying very hard to be shocking in this area. You know, he's inviting his friends, people like Coleridge and Turner, people who are accustomed to upstairs downstairs culture, to come down into low dark service areas essentially to see priceless works of art and antiquity. He's trying to be very shocking.
And what is, just on a practical level, it looks to me as though he's either this was an outside area previously, or has he knocked up through three floors of the building?
He's knocked up through two floors of the building. Quite simply, you can see the back of some of the planes of the picture room. The room literally opens. You have two rooms which open together. He's a great one for top lighting by having clever shafts to allow light to filter down into lower floors. In this particular space, he's using a barrel vault in glass. In this particular example, he uses yellow glass. There's a lot of yellow glass in the museum, and Soane uses that because most of the collection is of Mediterranean origins. And of course, in the Mediterranean, it's sunny, and in London, it's cloudy. And yellow glass gives you that kind of sunny Mediterranean feel.
Yes, it would be an altogether different feeling if the get if the glass up there were of the normal sort. Slightly colder, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, it would be as grey and cloudy as it is on any given day in London, whereas the yellow glass, you know, makes it sunny and light, and I think you need a little bit of levity injected when you're in a low-ceilinged hermit's cell. Moving out of the monk's area, you move into what's known called his crypt, what had been the wine cellar beneath the stables of number 13. It's called the crypt because it's full of objects associated with death, and it's supposed to be a bit creepy.
Was the corpse not enough?
No. Certainly. Okay. It's deliberately dark. It's lit with grills from above. You have to watch your feet because there are a few steps, but it is very fun.
I just noticed the crossbow. There's a crossbow. I presume that's if the visitors get out of hand.
Yeah, just get through in just a sec. Very busy today.
Well, it's good and busy here today. Lots of people moving through. We're passing through some Chinese. There could be dogs, there could be dragons. Very large sculptures there. And through some low-ceilinged areas. It's absolutely true what you said about the cleverness in the way that he uses light. I know the same thing is true of the Dulwich Picture House as well, with a big dome, much like the one that's above us at the moment, letting in their beautiful sunlight.
Yeah, we're currently in the centre of the crypt, beneath Soane's dome, so it allows light to filter down into the crypt, lighting his fantastic sarcophagus beneath. I mean, as I said, the crypt is full of objects associated with death, but at the centre is the sarcophagus, which you just can't get away from. It's so incredible and large. It's the sarcophagus of Pharaoh Seti I, so one of the most important Egyptian pharaohs. That dates it to about 3,500 years old, and it comes from the Valley of the Kings. It was discovered by a famous Georgian, or 18th century Egyptologist, an Italian circus strongman turned adventurer called Giovanni Battista Belzoni, who discovered it in Thebes, got legal permission to remove it, so there's no dodgy stealing going on. He brought it to London and offered it to the British Museum for £2,000, but they refused it, saying it was too expensive.
They can steal their own.
Well, more fool them, really, because it's just the most fantastic object and one of the most important Egyptian antiquities outside of Egypt. But of course, Soane had the perfect spot for it, and he had loads of money. So he bought it. He was hailed a hero for saving it for the nation. Had to knock down the back wall of the museum to get it in. So it's never been moved since. And during the Second World War, when the majority of the collection was evacuated to mines in Wales for safekeeping, this was just covered in sandbags, and the curators hoped for the best. Obviously, the museum didn't receive a direct hit during the Blitz, but it would have been awful, but no, everything is okay. The sarcophagus is absolutely beautiful. It's made of a single piece of alabaster, which glows orange if you shine a torch through it, or your mobile phone through it. It's covered in hieroglyphs, which tell the story of the Book of Gates, which was the Egyptian religious text talking about the soul's journey from this life to the next. There's actually a relief of the Egyptian goddess Nut inside it. She was the goddess who'd lead you to the afterlife. And unfortunately, Soane didn't know any of this, because, you know, the Rosetta Stone had been discovered during his lifetime, but it hadn't been deciphered yet, so he didn't know what the hieroglyphs meant, which is a bit of a shame.
And what does it tell us about the journey into the next life?
I'm not an Egyptologist.
Oh, you don't know either. Oh, well, you're a step ahead of Soane, but there's still more on the journey. Incredible, actually, because you can see where we were a few moments ago. We've got the bust of Soane, and we've got... Now, who's our fellow here gesturing with the fig leaf covering his...
His various parts, yes. This is a cast of the Apollo Belvedere, one of the most important antique sculptures anywhere in the world. The original, of course, is in the Vatican Museum. But this cast was made in the early 18th century for the famous architect Earl Lord Burlington. And I rather like to think that Soane bought it not only because it was the Apollo Belvedere, but also because, it had belonged to this great inspirational architect who'd come before Soane himself.
And this was the last phase of the museum?
No, we're at the back of number 13 now. So this is, we're at the back, the museum, which Soane extended into when he bought number 13 in 1807. So we're sort of middle of the time scale at this point. Of course, various bits and pieces are bought at different times. He continued to move things around right up till 20 days before he died.
Oh, so it's all mixed together then?
Yes.
And what about the character of the things that he was collecting later on in his life during this period where he's grieving?
Well, actually, you know, yes, he was grieving and yes, he was a bit depressed, but I think he remained very dynamic. He continued to collect anything that inspired him and of any medium. You know, he doesn't just collect paintings or sculpture or antiquities or drawings or books. He collects them all. And you've got to bear in mind that he's collecting principally from art dealers and in auction houses here in London. So he is hampered a little bit by what happens to be on sale at any given time. We've got a lot of sale catalogues upstairs with his handwriting in them, with him sort of writing notes, you know, putting prices on that he's willing to pay for certain things, putting prices on that he did pay for certain things. So, you know, there's a lot of archive relating to what he thought about collecting, what he did collect.
So I presume then that the dealers of these sort of things must have had half an eye on the fact that this collection's gradually developing. We've got one of these for you.
Absolutely. I think there are a huge number of people who actually directly offered things to Soane because they knew, you know, this eccentric man who collected all sorts of things for his fantastic museum. From my point of view, one of the best examples is the architectural drawings of Robert and James Adam, which Soane bought in 1833. We've got 85% of the surviving Adam drawings, you know, hugely important architects who introduced neoclassicism to the country. They were sold to Soane by the Adam brothers' niece, who'd inherited the drawings collection. She wasn't able to sell them because they weren't old enough to be of antiquarian interest, and she'd heard about this eccentric man in London who collected architectural paraphernalia, and she simply had her lawyer write to him and say, you know, would you like them? And he said, yeah, sure, have 200 quid.
Well, this is getting to be a habit. Every time I leave a room, I discover something disturbing on the way out. There's manacles on the way out of that area.
Yeah, Soane was a member of the abolition movement. He wasn't actively involved, but he had a lot of friends. You know, he cared about it a great deal. He put the slave manacles up, you know, to make the point, you know, slavery is horrible. It's a very pointed thing to put up on your wall.
Londonist Out Loud is available free as a stream at Londonist.com or a weekly download via iTunes. Hit us up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud. Tweet at Londonist Sound and check out images of our guests via the Londonist Out Loud stream on Instagram.
We've now come upstairs to Soane's picture room at the back of number 14, which he purchased in 1824 because he had bought Hogarth's selection series, which you can see to either side in the space. 1824 is a fairly significant year because it's the year in which the National Gallery opened, not, of course, in its current building, which hadn't been built yet, but in a townhouse on Pall Mall. And the National Gallery was in possession of some 36, 37 paintings. Soane had over 100, and this particular room is his response. We've got a beautiful, enormous canaletto over the chimneypiece, which we removed about 2 years ago for the big canaletto exhibition in the Sainsbury wing. Removing it was quite a job, but it did mean we were able to rehang the space and take it back to the arrangement that Soane himself had. So you've got to bear that in mind when you're in here.
This canaletto is breathtaking, but I wonder if you wouldn't mind giving us a description of it.
Certainly, I'll do my best. So it's a typical canaletto, basically a sort of postcard picture view of Venice. You're looking down towards the Accademia Bridge. You're sort of standing a little bit further up from St. Mark's Square. And like most canalettos, you're a little bit above eye level. You have to sort of imagine that you're about 40 feet tall to understand canaletto's viewpoint. We're looking over the Grand Canal, various boats, some gondolas, and also you can see on the street various people going about their daily lives. And the nice thing about canalettos images is that he shows the architecture as it was. You know, he doesn't either beautify or make things more ugly for any reason. He simply shows it as it is. It's absolutely beautiful.
Yes, it almost is photographic quality, isn't it?
Yeah, but don't get carried away because we've got two smaller canalettos above it, one showing St. Mark's Square and one showing the Rialto Bridge. So they're both lovely as well, but smaller, so people tend not to notice them.
I think what seems to tie that together with Soane's view overall really is this sense of depth of perspective. You walk into the room and it feels as though you're looking far down this river. You must be able to see a mile there easily.
Yeah, and Soane did that quite deliberately. There's a glass panel in the door to the room, so you can be at the far end of the museum looking down through the glass panel and it looks like you're looking into Venice, which of course is helped by the fact that this space is top lit, so the lighting works. Soane does that deliberately. You know, top lighting is the best way to light any picture gallery, as we all know. But But this particular ceiling is another example of Soane sort of doing innovative architectural things. It was made in a carpenter's yard off-site and brought here. It's in the eclectic style, so it's Gothic in form with classical motifs affixed to it. And it's really, you know, despite all the incredible things in this space, it's one of the most beautiful things about the room, I think.
We can see as well, if we look between the paintings, a brass latch and some brass handles there, and that looks to me to be repeated on the opposite side of the room. And you're going to open those up and we'll see what you're talking about with the planes and the paintings.
So basically the sides of the room, the walls open, what we call the planes, and inside are further paintings. On one side we have various things, including cartoons by Raphael. We've got a large Colcott showing a mythological scene. And we've got Hogarth's Rake's Progress, which of course tells the story of a dissolute young man who inherits lots of money, dumps his fiancée, gets into trouble, ends up in debtor's prison, and ends up finally in Bedlam, but still being looked after by his ever faithful dumped fiancée. So it's a moral tale. It has comical elements, but it's fairly sad. So if you're ever at the Soane Museum, you come and look at it, and hopefully have one of our fantastic warders run you through the story. It's really great fun.
Well, we are on the first floor now. If you're an American listener, we're on the second floor. We're looking down over the square. We've come through rooms, apartments, they feel like, that I'm going to have a, pop at Regency style.
Yeah, you're absolutely spot on. On the first floor above number 13 are Soane's two drawing rooms, one, of course, being the famous bright yellow room, Turner's patent yellow. That's Turner the colour man, not Turner the painter. Absolutely beautiful. A more sort of domestic level of the building, really, but still filled with beautiful objects from the collection, including various family portraits. But if you come through the jib door at one end of that room, you'll pass through into the neighbouring house, number 12, the house which John and Eliza first bought in 1792 when they first came to Lincoln's Inn Fields. And this house is what has had attention lavished on it during the first phase, first of two phases, of our big £7 million project, Opening Up the Soane. And in that first phase, we installed a beautiful conservation suite, not open to the public, but on the second floor of the building. We're currently on the first floor of the building, where we've got an incredible and really very useful, actually, temporary exhibition gallery filled with furniture inspired by Soane's own work, and made by Goppion in Milan. We're currently showing an exhibition on Piranesi's drawings for his publication on the subject of Pistum in Italy. Beautiful drawings, 16 of them, 14 of which are from Soane's own collection. And then if you go downstairs in this building, you'll find John and Eliza's breakfast room as they had it when they first moved here in 1792. And next to that we have our beautiful new museum shop, which I do hope everyone will visit. See his nose so well.
Oh, yes. Yes, he's got quite a hooter. And the bust of Sir John Soane, of course, is looking down onto the sarcophagus and seeming to admire the collection, so he's still here in a way. I wanted to ask you, there's a few rather moralistic flourishes in the collection, deliberately so. What about his dark side? Was there something about John Soane that wasn't wholly beneficent and benevolent and moralistic?
I wouldn't like to think so. There's nothing in the archive that relates to that sort of thing. Rather comically, the Rake's Progress, the great moral tale within the museum, was actually bought by Eliza Soane, his wife. So rather amusing thing for a wife to buy for her husband as a gift.
Is she trying to tell somebody something?
I hope not. No, I mean, Soane was devoted to Eliza, so it's more funny than anything else. I mean, Soane had a great opinion of himself. The Francis Chantrey bust is placed physically above Flaxman's two sculptures of Michelangelo and Raphael. But despite having, you know, an ego on him, which I think is fair enough because, you know, he was this great, great gifted architect, I don't think that there was anything dark or sinister about him at all. He collected in this very impressive, almost extravagant way, and some objects within the collection are, you know, associated with the dark side of life. But, you know, he collected so many different things. There are huge different facets to the collection, which don't necessarily reflect on his personality, I don't think.
Now, his architectural style perhaps wasn't recognised right away, or the importance of his contribution to architecture in the long term wasn't. And I know that one or two buildings, the Bank of England being perhaps one of them, much to the chagrin of Pevsner, was fiddled around with, and a lot of, that's an architectural term by the way, was fiddled around with, and a lot of Soane's stuff was removed or destroyed or replaced.
I mean, as I said earlier on, an awful lot has been demolished, a lot wasn't built in the first place. I mean, one of the great tragedies is that a large portion of the Bank of England was demolished in the 1920s, and that his work at the Palace of Westminster burnt down with the rest of it. So yes, terribly sad, but I mean, I suppose that's within the context of any architect's work. Most architects, you know, a lot of their stuff is now gone. It's just the sad evolution of a great city like London, really.
Well, you say that, but what I notice, a lot of the public buildings he seemed to do for departments that we no longer have, but departments with wonderful names, like something like the Department of New Pieces of Paper or something, and he made all these lovely public buildings, and then about 40 years later there seems to have been a cull of his public buildings in, I think, the 1860s or somewhere around there.
Yes, I mean, you've got to bear in mind that in the 1860s the country had a huge amount of money, so they'd be looking to update at any given cost. I don't think it's a personal slight on Soane particularly, but yes, it is worth noting that a lot of his work is now gone. But having said that, his architectural drawings survive. We're cataloguing them, and we're cataloguing them online with high quality digital photographs of each drawing, so gradually you'll be able to see more and more of them. Just go on the Soane website and click on collections.
and of course the Soane website is
soane.org.uk.
And I wonder, of course, people, if they haven't been tempted by now to come and have a look around, then I'm sure a look at the website will convince them. But I wondered, in terms of his surviving architecture, what would you recommend as maybe typifying his style, or just being a very exciting piece of work?
Well, I mean, principally the museum, I'm afraid, which sounds a little bit arrogant. But, I mean, also there are fabulous other places, such as Mogger Hanger House or Pitts Hanger House in Ealing. It's a really wonderful example. It's the house which Soane actually bought for his country house. It's rather comical, isn't it, that a country house could be in Ealing. But it had been a house which he'd worked on as an apprentice with dance, and then purchased it and did a lot of work on it himself. And it's absolutely fantastic. Of course, it's currently undergoing a large conservation project. Very well-deserved money went towards that. That's very exciting. So people should go and visit it and see it and really see what incredible architecture Soane was capable of when under his own steam.
Mm-hmm. So that's the stop-off point on the way here. Well, Frances Sass, thanks so much for showing us around today.
It was a great pleasure. Please, please do everyone come and visit.
Here she stands. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Dr. Frances Sass. Thanks too to Becca Evans and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Jack Hurd and Rory Anderson, and I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. Inch by inch, waiting for the river's care, straining for the blueing waves calling from the shore.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.